This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Matthew Shepard, a gay University of Wyoming student, murdered, a hate crime. James Gray, African-American, he too, murdered, killed in Jasper, Texas, another crime of hate. In recent months and years, we've also seen crimes of hate on a larger scale. The two-state shooting spree, a former University of Illinois student, Benjamin Smith. Smith killed two people and wounded nine others this summer. And last spring, the murders of high school students by fellow students in Colorado. And in the 1990s, we've witnessed the violence of extremists, the bombings of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City and the World Trade Center in New York City. Intolerance, bigotry, extremist movements, and violence. In this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, we look into extremism and crimes of hate. Two guests join us this afternoon to answer our questions. One is a philosopher, the other a political scientist and sociologist. John George is a professor of political science and sociology at the University of Central Oklahoma. Stuart Rosenbaum is an associate professor of philosophy at Baylor University. Stuart Rosenbaum is also co-editor with Robert Baird of the book Hatred, Bigotry, and Prejudice, Definitions, Causes, and Solutions. And John George is co-author with Laird Wilcox of the book American Extremists, Militias, Supremacists, Klansmen, Communists, and Others. Both books are published by Prometheus. Listeners, your questions and comments are encouraged this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. John George, Stuart Rosenbaum, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thanks
Hello,
for
I'm
joining
happy
us.
To be here also.
John George, I want to start here making a point that you and your co-author make in your book, American Extremists, that extremism in and of itself is not criminal, not necessarily violent. What does it mean to be an extremist?
Well, we believe extremism is more a matter of style and tactics than it is of goals, and we delineate some characteristics of extremists, whether no matter what type they are. We also believe that you must differentiate between extremism and terrorism, something the media doesn't do too well quite often. I do it in a rather simple way. Extremists are character assassins. Terrorists are assassins. Extremists will say all manner of nasty things about you. Terrorists will hurt or kill you. Pat Robertson and Louis Farrakhan, typical right-wing extremists, will throw out all sorts of character assassination in your direction, but they will not send people out to blow up your house or your school or a building. Terrorists will do exactly that. So I think really we need to separate the terms extremism and terrorism. All terrorists are certainly extremists, mm-hmm. but very, very few extremists ever cross that line and become terrorists.
Yeah, but to what extent does hate and intolerance feed extremist groups, feed terrorist groups?
Well, I think you can see some of that, but if you'll think about the people who've pulled off terrorism recently, let's use Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols. They never belonged to any extremist group. And that's probably one of the reasons they were successful. Had they belonged to a militia group of, say, 25 members, probably someone would have, and others heard about this in the group, they would have tried to talk them out of it, or somebody would have actually tipped off law enforcement that this kind of thing was going to happen. Because the average political extremist does not favor blowing up buildings, especially where innocent people are. And in fact, many political extremists that I've talked to believe that the government blew up the Murrah Building. They don't believe that Terry Nichols and Tim McVeigh had anything to do with it.
Hmm. Stuart Rosenbaum, you want to jump in and make a comment?
Yes, I'm not quite sure what to say about terrorists and extremists. I've looked at the book that John George produced, and I found it very useful and extremely informative, and it seems to me that he did a lot of work on that book. Our book, Baird's book and mine, is different, it seems to me, in that we're not dealing with the nuts and bolts of details. extremist groups and terrorists, but rather the issue of how in the world we can understand this phenomenon of hatred and how can we attempt to deal with it in an effective way socially in our culture.
Your book is a book of pieces written by many different people on many different topics within this, if we might say, this umbrella of definitions, causes, and solutions, hatred, bigotry, and prejudice.
Yeah, there's this phenomenon that's generally known as xenophobia, fear or hatred of people who are different from ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend, I think humans tend in some way to get isolated in their own individual groups and then to be at least suspicious of others who are not part of those groups. And so the whole problem is how do we produce some way of addressing the issue of isolation of individuals within their own groups apart from others which they suspect and sometimes hate and sometimes terrorize and attack. And there are several solutions that are proposed to this. I mean, one of the standard ones, I mean, a lot of religious people think that this sort of phenomenon is just a natural part of human sin. And the only way out for many religious people is to hope for salvation. And that way is a way out for those people. Others, sociobiologists or evolutionary psychologists, perhaps think that there are laws of biological nature that just require humans to isolate themselves in groups and to be suspicious and to hate members of other groups. And there are others who are not quite so rigid and doctrinaire who think that culture plays a large role in our isolation from one another in groups. And on that latter possibility, there are significant things that we can do as a society to address the whole issue. And that's the one that seems to me most positive.
And we sociologists, political science types, agree totally with that last one.
Yeah. There is an interesting essay in Hatred, Bigotry, and Prejudice from Martin Marty of the University of Chicago about civility, and he talks about this, he writes about this amazing conference, or I guess I would call it that, a coming together of people who are, their views are diametrically opposed on a number of really hot-button topics. Abortion, one of them. What are the others, Stuart Rosenbaum?
Well, there are reproductive rights, rights of homosexuals, population, church-state issues, things like that that tend to get people rigidly separated and suspicious of one another.
Yeah. And these folks from very different viewpoints came together, sat across the table from one another, and looked one another in the eye and talked about their views.
Yes, and it seems to me that this is a very productive possibility. This is something that might be pursued on a large scale. And I think I would be very favorable toward the development of groups like this, if possible, because I think these things do make possible constructively addressing these kinds of divisions between groups. I've had experience like this myself that seems to suggest that it does work. People don't change their views, perhaps, but they do learn to respect and to respect the other group.
John George, maybe you could talk with us about why this could be a remedy, why this could help.
Well, I'm in total agreement with that because, as Stuart said, I've personally had this kind of experience myself, more on a one-on-one, two-on-two, that sort of thing, because although people don't change their views, they do begin to look at the other person as human. And quite often in situations like this, people want to dehumanize those who strongly disagree with them. And, of course, dehumanization is the first step on the road toward genocide. And that's something we're doing our very, very best to avoid. I can remember some years ago there were some John Birchers who actually told some people that I was a card-carrying communist. Well, That's very strange, because all my life I've been sort of an avid anti-communist, and I still am. Just like I was an avid anti-Bircher, while at the same time I would defend both the communist and the Bircher's civil liberties. But anyway, this one, John Bircher, got to know me, not only decided I was not a communist, he also decided he had never told anyone that I was. Now, I think he's a relatively honest guy, so I think we see psychological blocking there on his part. He just now thinks I'm a pretty good fellow who's wrong about most things, and certainly he never thought I was a communist. So quite often, I think, when you look at the other person as human, it does make things better. It certainly makes for better dialogue. And just before we went on the air, Stuart and I were talking about a kind of a decline in civility we seem to have had over the years, and I think these groups that would try to develop that sort of thing would be very, very good.
Mm. On the downside of this essay from Martin Marty, folks in this situation, in this coming together, voiced frustration. I'm going to quote here now, voiced frustration that the network of people and religious groups and communities who regularly work at civil discourse is alarmingly small and weak.
That's right. I think that's right, and I think that's extremely unfortunate. And it seems to me that what Marty is suggesting is that religious people in particular should be at the forefront of this effort to produce more understanding among divergent groups than they are now. As it has traditionally been in the past, religious groups have torn people apart. And he thinks that's not necessary. In fact, it's contrary to the spirit of most religions. And so he's suggesting this is something that religious groups in particular should be involved in. I think I agree with that.
Yeah. Oh, certainly. No question.
The two of you agree that we've seen a reduction in civility in recent years?
I do. Do you agree, Stuart?
I think I do agree with that.
Yeah.
And what do you think is at the root of that?
I'm not a social psychologist. And
well, I'm not a sociologist either, but if I were going to be an armchair sociologist, I would say that this is the sort of thing that one might expect from a society such as ours, where no one is in control, and the media is in a way running rampant, and there are no controlling ideals for the culture at large. We give sort of lip service to democracy and community, but those ideals are not somehow strongly embedded in our media anywhere. What's embedded in our media rather is a kind of radical individualism that invites people to reinforce their uniqueness or even their singularity.
I do think that a great majority of people believe in the theoretical concepts of what the democratic society, the open society, should be, but they quite often hedge when we give specifics. For instance, there have been a number of studies done which indicate that if you ask people, do you believe in freedom of speech for everyone, no matter what, or freedom of speech, press, and assembly for everyone, no matter what their views are, that somewhere around 90% will say that they do. But then if you say, should a racist, should a communist, should so on and so forth, the people we don't like, should they have the right to speak in public, should they be allowed to speak at our colleges and so forth, suddenly that 90% becomes about 40%. So we do accept the theoretical premises of the open society, but when actual examples are put in our face, a lot of people do not really believe in the open society. They want to shut down certain kinds of dialogue and want to shut down certain types of debate.
Hmm. It seems that we are walking a line often between preserving our rights, First Amendment rights, and preventing harm.
Oh, sure. Of course we are. Every open society does that. Has to. I mean, that's why people are so angry at the ACLU so much of the time, because they're always defending somebody who's not particularly nice.
Hmm. Let's talk about David Koresh.
He's not particularly nice, is he?
David Koresh and his followers, seen as religious extremists, now we have a reexamination of what happened at Waco. What are your thoughts about what happened there, John George?
Well, Wilcox and I have always believed that the government didn't handle a thing very well. The ATF and the FBI didn't handle it too well. We also think that the evidence is overwhelming that the Davidians themselves started those fires from the inside, and nothing that's come out recently has given any evidence that was not the case. I mean, you actually heard them saying it. You remember, the FBI had them bugged. You could hear them talking. Probably you've seen the thing about Waco that was on Frontline. To me, that's been the most objective examination of it that I've seen.
But back in 1993, when the FBI and the ATF went in, there really, in your view, wasn't a call for that?
I didn't think so, because they were treating it as though it was a hostage situation, and there's no evidence that it was a hostage situation. And in fact, some of the people who were specialists in that type of a religious cult tried to tell the FBI it was not a hostage situation. Some guy, I'm trying to think, Bill Martin down at Rice, you probably know him, Stuart.
I've heard the name, I don't know him.
Yeah, Bill was one of them trying to tell them that they probably didn't have a hostage situation here, but somehow or other, a number of people got the idea that it truly was, and they treated it as a hostage situation, and that was probably a big mistake.
Here's something that is scary from your book, John George. A scandal in Canada that you write about, 1993, the Canadian government had a paid informant in a right-wing group who was directing a campaign of terrorism.
Yeah, there you go. Now, see, this is something that's bothered us since time immemorial, because you've always had law enforcement inserting infiltrators into groups. Now, the problem is getting the right person to insert, because sometimes if somebody's very eager to go in there and be an informant for you, that's probably the person you don't want, because that person is going to tell you what you want to hear, is going to make up all sorts of tales to make himself or herself seem more important, and sometimes such a person will become an agent provocateur, and that's what this person became. He became an agent provocateur. The real prototype of that was a guy who was in the social revolutionaries in pre-communist Russia named Envo Azar. And Envo Azar was a police agent inside, an informant for the police, in Tsarist police, inside this revolutionary group. And he was actually participating in killing police to show that he was a good member of the group. So that's the ultimate there. So this is not surprising what this Canadian guy did. It's also a little bit reminiscent of these hate crime hoaxes. You know, something between 10% and 20% of the hate crimes in this country are phony. They are things made up by people. Suddenly swastikas and kill the Jews appear on a synagogue, and it turns out a 19- and 17-year-old Jewish guy who belonged to the synagogue wrote that on the wall there to focus on anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is out there. Well, we know it's out there. And to pull off a hate crime hoax like that is, to me, the same as a hate crime.
How often does the government run amok, do you think, in its efforts to track extremist groups?
You know, that's very difficult to determine, but it sometimes does. There's no question about it. There was a guy named Tommy the Traveler Tongyai back in the late 60s, early 70s, who was inside all these left-wing groups like the Progressive Labor Party and Students for Democratic Society and so forth. And Tommy worked for sheriff's departments. I think he even worked for the FBI. And he was a total agent provocateur. He would say something like, "We ought to blow up the draft board." And they'd say, "Well, we don't want to kill anybody." "Well, we can blow it up at night." "Well, we don't know how to get any explosives." "I think I know a guy I can get explosives from." So he would get the explosives, give them to them, and then when they went to blow up the draft board, they would be arrested, and Tommy would fade into the woodwork. So that kind of thing is certainly running amok.
Hatred is something we all know. We know what it's like to feel that emotion, that passion. And extremism, it's probably as old as humankind.
Yes.
Do you think we're experiencing more hate, seeing more crimes of hate, and
no,
more extremism?
Definitely not. In fact, I would highly recommend an article and a book. The book is by Jim Jacobs and Kim Potter, published by Oxford University Press. And the name of it is Hate Crimes, Criminal Law, and Identity Politics. And before that was an article in the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology for winter of 1996 by Jim Jacobs and Jessica Henry called The Social Construction of a Hate Crime Epidemic, and they pretty well show that we are not experiencing an epidemic of hate crimes. Hate crimes are not rising.
Stuart Rosenbaum, what do you think?
Well, I would have to bow to those sources because I don't have any specific information about that, but I have seen recently that Jerry Falwell has met with Mel White, the gay activist minister, and who and Falwell apparently recanted some of his extreme rhetoric about gays, homosexuals, and so it seems to me there's some suggestion there that perhaps things aren't as bad as they might be.
I'd like to comment on that because I meant to bring that up a while ago, and I'm really glad you did, Stuart. Falwell did some things. See, Mel White ghostwrote Falwell's autobiography, just like he ghostwrote Pat Robertson's autobiography. None of those guys write anything themselves. They're too busy to do that, so they have to have ghostwriters. But Mel is a longtime gay activist, but when he wrote their stuff, he was not out of the closet. And jail for protesting something, he asked Pat Robertson to come and meet with him because he wanted to talk to him, and Pat would not meet with him. And he said, he's not going to convince me that homosexuality is not a sin, which is not what Mel wanted to do. And Mel said, he knows that's not what I want to do. I want to get him to tell his Christian followers that it is wrong to beat the hell out of gay people. Well, essentially, that's what Falwell did. He told his followers, you should not hurt these people. They are our brothers and sisters, and even though what they do is wrong and sinful, etc., etc., you should not lay a hand on them. No good Christian should do that. So what Mel White wanted Robertson to do and he wouldn't do, Falwell has done. I think we have to commend Falwell for that.
It's back to Martin Marty's.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Absolutely. That's what reminded me of it a while ago, but you asked another very good question, and I forgot about it.
We've heard folks say recently, Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, among them, saying hate groups used to appeal to older white men who had little education, but now they're working to recruit middle-class high school and college students, male and female. Is Mark Potok and other folks who express this view, are they right?
Well, I don't think they're having very much success in recruiting such people. And it wasn't always older white men. In fact, a lot of hate groups have tried to get younger people. If you want to talk about the ones who've done violence, a lot of them are people between the ages of 15 and 30 who are unemployed or underemployed, blue-collar people. And they're the kind of people who get into violent altercations, whether they're ideological or not. Now, I've known Mark for some time just by interviews. He interviewed me a couple of times for USA Today. I thought he did an excellent job when he was with USA Today, and I'm sure his talents are well used at Southern Poverty Law Center. But I do think Southern Poverty Law Center tends to exaggerate these things. I think that they, the Center for Democratic Renewal and the Political Research Associates, tend to exaggerate both the strength of size, the strength and the influence, all three of those things, of the extreme right in this country.
Mm-hmm. Stuart Rosenbaum, why do people join hate groups?
I think it's a very difficult question, but there are these three general explanations, but it seems to me that almost everybody at a certain point in their life needs a way of identifying themselves as an individual, and any kind of group that you find offers an opportunity for that kind of identification that provides a kind of meaning to one's life. And so I think everybody is vulnerable at a certain point in their life to the appeal of specific groups that have strong identification, strong identities. And it seems to me that's probably one of the most important factors there.
I think that's very good, Stuart, and I'd like to add something to it. A long time ago, when he was about 14 or 15 years old, my co-author, Laird Wilcox, read a wonderful little book, which I recommend a lot because it's easy to read, and it's very short, and that's Eric Hoffer's The True Believer, which came out in 1951. And in this, Eric Hoffer says, I want to quote him, "A rising mass movement attracts and holds a following not by doctrine and promises, but by the refuge it offers from the anxieties, barrenness, and meaninglessness of an individual existence." He goes on to say that by embracing a holy cause and dedicating their energies and substance to its advancement, they can find a new life full of purpose and meaning. And I think that dovetails very well with what Stuart just said.
Hmm. Let me add to that. In the book, together with Laird Wilcox, you write that you know, extremism is not new, something that we've already said, but also that it can be and has been beneficial.
Occasionally it can. Occasionally. For instance, the Communist Party was the first organized political group in this country to come out for racial integration. So who can fault them for that one? Of course, they were faulted quite a lot back then, but they did that in the 30s.
Hmm. And the American Revolution is certainly led by folks with extreme political views.
Well, some of them were extreme, but like Sam Adams, who, by the way, was a real radical firebrand and one of the few people who was in the forefront of, let's see, the starting 11 of the founding fathers who was actually Christian. Most of the starting 11 were deists, but Sam was very much the radical firebrand. But some of these people really weren't that different from the, their ideas were not that different from what the British system was. They just wanted the freedom to practice these ideas independently. And that's why some people who are real hotshots on this, I'm not, maintain that our Revolutionary War was not really a revolution, that it was simply, better titled, a war for independence, because we did not really change too much of the way things were done in the UK.
Hmm. How many people actually join extremist groups?
Not many. Most of them are very small. The largest groups would be those that are less extreme. For instance, I would suggest to you that Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition is maybe the mildest of far-right extremist groups, and it's also the largest. The John Birch Society probably is one of the milder ones. They have less than 20,000 members, I would imagine, these days. I can't think of any groups on the very far right that have more than a couple of thousand, and nor any on the very far left that have over about 5,000. I think the Communist Party has 5,000 or 6,000 members now, way, way down from its time in the 30s and into the 40s when they may have had as many as 80,000 members. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about groups that are small, but they will always try to make you think they are much larger than they are, and other groups that hate them or who are consumed by them try to make you think that they are much larger than they are. I can remember when Jim Wickstrom was running a group that's almost totally defunct now, although people still talk about it, Posse Comitatus. He was claiming 600,000 members. He had about 600 members.
Hmm.
And this is very common.
Yeah. Well, this is something that you also raise in your book. You know, just what does it mean to be a member? Do you go to meetings, or do you take an oath, or do you...
Okay, now, there's a thing we have to differentiate. If you're talking about mailing lists, mm-hmm. let's say there are 10,000 people who are active members of various militias throughout this country. Well, there are probably another 50,000 on their mailing list. And sometimes when people talk about members, they're just talking about people on the mailing list. Well, I used to be on every mailing list you can imagine, and Laird Wilcox still is. And in fact, I was four members of Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority once. I used to have the four little membership cards up on my wall. Professor John George, Dr. John George, Dr. John H. George, and Mr. John George were all four members of Christian Coalition. Yet I never joined. I wrote for some information and sent them $1 to cover postage. And the next thing I know, I was four different members of Moral Majority.
Hmm.
Yeah, so it's a pretty loose thing.
It's like all those mailings you get from Publishers Clearinghouse or Publishers.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Also, you have to remember there are Ku Klux Klan claverns of maybe three or four people, a guy and his brother-in-law and his brother-in-law's cousin and that sort of thing. The Klan, if you look on page 31 of Wilcox in my book, There's a picture of my uncle's car, 1925. A Klan police chief and his henchmen darn near kill my uncle. They did kill a guy in the car with him, and they did wound another one. My uncle escaped without blemish, but he was pretty shook. Well, back then, there were like 105 million people in the United States, and fairly conservative estimates say there were 1.5 to 2 million Klansmen at the time. Well, now we have 270 million people in this country, and the best estimates indicate that there are no more than 5,000 total Klansmen in this country at this time. A black judge, and I'm sorry I can't remember his name, about 10 or 12 years ago said, when I was a kid, there was danger from the Klan. Now it's more dangerous for you to be in the Klan, because quite often when they have a demonstration, the police have to prevent 1,500 demonstrators from killing or maiming 20 Klansmen. It's very common. In fact, it happened in New York. There were between 800 and 1,000 demonstrators against 16 Klansmen in New York here a couple of weeks ago.
Question for both of you. What has driven your interest in this topic, in these topics?
Stuart, you want to address it first?
Well, the only thing I can think of is that this is a real problem, not just for American society, but for the entire world, I think. I mean, with the growth of the Internet, we're becoming an international community, but the large question, it seems to me, that's compelling is, how can we be a community at all if we insist on dividing ourselves into groups like this? And that's true of this country, and it's true of us internationally as well. So it seems to me we need to think carefully about what options are open to us in dealing with this kind of situation.
I would agree with every word he said, and I would add that, of course, being interested in such people on the fringes as Wilcox and I have for a long time, we also brought to that and became even more so very, very strict civil libertarians. We both are very avid about that sort of thing. We think that the open society is the best kind. We think that the answer to obnoxious, hate-filled speech is not to suppress them, but more speech, to show people that it is not a good thing. Let me give a small example of what happened to me in 1967. I was at a dinner party when I was a graduate student, and there were about 10 people at the table, and this guy said the word nigger a couple of times. Well, the third time he said it, I told him, we're both guests here, but if you say that word one more time, I'm going to leave. And I said it where everyone could hear it. He apologized. He didn't say it anymore. Sometimes by showing social disapproval, you can get people to think along those lines. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention was what got me interested in just extremist groups proper. The first thing was Nikita Khrushchev, and I could not imagine what people saw in him, you know, Communist Party members in this country. And then what got me even more interested, at the end of 1960, beginning of 1961, I found out about Robert Welch and the John Birch Society, and found out that Mr. Welch had said that President Eisenhower was, and I quote, a dedicated conscious agent of the communist conspiracy. Well, I found that just wildly fascinating, that a man with 6 years of college, who's a former vice president of the National Association of Manufacturers and who'd become very wealthy through making candy and had all kinds of education, could actually think that our president and his brother and our head of the CIA and his brother, who was Secretary of State, and on and on and on, were actually in the pocket of guys like Joseph Stalin. And so I found it totally fascinating. At the same time, I felt that even though these people say horrible things, their rights to say them and their rights to print them have to be defended.
Mm. Yeah, I think I agree about that. I think, to put it in a typical way, John says he's a card-carrying member of the ACLU.
Not anymore. I quit them in a huff in 1984, but I am more civil libertarian than they are.
I was intending to describe your position, but...
Okay. Go ahead.
I think I agree with that entirely. And it seems to me the problem is how we deal with people's expressions of their liberties that are socially destructive.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that John's suggestion was really a good one. Enough people have to think carefully enough or have to be responsible enough in their interactions to be able to stand up and say, if you use that word one more time, I'm going to leave, so that people can begin to process what it is they're saying,
yeah.
How it is they're behaving.
Yeah, I think it really does work. Now, there's some people who are not people of goodwill, and that's not going to work on them at all. In fact, one time a guy was saying some anti-Semitic things, and I said, what have you got against Jews? He said, why, you know any Jews? I said, only my mother. And he, instead of backing off and being embarrassed, he said, well, you damn Jews think you run the world and all that sort of thing. And I said, well, I think you're pretty sick, but you have a right to say it, and I think I'm going to leave. And that's about. And you've got to do that. You've got to express social disapproval of people like that. You have to do it.
Yeah. The problem is that in situations like that, people too frequently go their own ways with their stereotypes intact.
Yeah.
And though they're challenged, perhaps, they're not challenged in a way that enables them to deal constructively with the challenge. So they just gather up their perspective and go on their way.
Yeah.
But it seems to me the suggestion of Martin Marty is probably the most useful one we could fasten on by way of making progress.
And I think the appendix in American Extremists, which talks about the statements that extremists will use.
Oh, the phony quotes.
The phony quotes,
yeah.
And that kind of thing would be handy to have at the table.
Well, while you've left me a wide opening there, you've given me a setup line. Paul Bowler and I did a book for Oxford University Press in 1989 called They Never Said It, a book of fake quotes. And that book is still available from Oxford. They've got a few hundred copies left, and whereas this fake quotes and fabricated documents, a common extremist tactic, Appendix 1, has 128 phony quotes in it. Paul's in my book has 230. And so that would, and another one I could mention is Ralph Key's book, Nice Guys Finish Seventh. It also has a thing of phony quotes. Phony quotes are used over and over and over again. I even still hear the ones attributed to Lenin and Khrushchev and so forth nowadays, even though there's no Soviet Union left.
Yeah. Here's two things I'd add to what you just said. These are two important points that you have here in the appendix. One, when the authenticity of a quotation is in question, the burden of proof is on the user,
right,
not the questioner. And quotes, documents should never be used unless they can be documented.
Right. If you're going to use it without documentation, you can say, well, now this has been attributed to Abraham Lincoln. I don't know whether he said it or not, but it's a good idea.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We're talking this afternoon with John George, professor of political science and sociology at the University of Central Oklahoma, and Stuart Rosenbaum, associate professor of philosophy at Baylor University. Stuart Rosenbaum is co-editor with Robert Baird of the book Hatred, Bigotry, and Prejudice, Definitions, Causes, and Solutions. John George is co-author with Laird Wilcox of the book American Extremists, Militias, Supremacists, Klansmen, Communists, and Others. Both books are published by Prometheus. Is the Internet having an impact on tolerance and or intolerance? Because it seems to me that hate groups could be active on the net, so too civil libertarians.
Everyone can have a web page who wants to. The craziest little communist group, the Revolutionary Communist Party, whose leader has lived in Europe for 20 straight years, has their web page. Everybody you've ever heard of has their web page. But yeah, so do the good guys. They have their web pages too, and it's something that's very hard for anybody to censor. And we're talking about censoring certain types of stuff from the Internet here, where you're going to have to, as I'm trying to think which guy said this in Stuart's book, I'm looking for it right now, but he said we may have to attack Sweden and Netherlands if we're going to stop this. And it's showing how ridiculous it is to talk about censoring certain things on the Internet.
Yeah, civility.
Which one was that? Was that Raymond Smith
without censorship?
That? Yeah, it was Raymond Smith. He said, to censor Internet filth at its origins, we would have to enlist the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who could start by invading Sweden and Holland.
Mm. Yeah, I have to admit that I had not, before I started on this second printing, second edition of this book, I had not spent much time looking around the web to find out what was there. But it really is shocking what's there. But at the same time, it's shocking. It seems to me that it's not qualitatively different from what's available in print media, normal print media, everywhere
right.
throughout the country.
Right.
It's but it is shocking. The Westboro Baptist Church website, for example, I did not know to exist. But once,
GodHatesFags.com, is that Fred Phelps?
GodHatesFags.com.
Yeah,
is the,
Fred Phelps.
URL. Right.
Terrible human being.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
but he has the right to free expression. That's what, and we've got a right to answer it. Mm-hmm. And especially who needs to answer it is literalist Christians, whose theology is essentially the same as his. But they need to answer him and talk about how hateful that is, and how people who believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible should not feel as Mr. Reverend Phelps does.
Right.
Should there be a separate criminal charge for a hate crime?
You want to address it, Stuart?
You go first.
I don't think so. No, I don't think it's very useful. And in fact, I think sometimes it can be counterproductive. And this is what Jim Jacobs and Kim Potter argue in their book, Hate Crimes, Criminal Law, and Identity Politics. And by the way, Jim Jacobs is the director of NYU Center for Research on Crime and Justice. And Kim Potter is a senior fellow, former senior research fellow at the New York NYU Center for Research on Crime and Justice. And their book is the most impressive thing that I've read on hate crimes, and I've done a bit of reading about that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my inclinations are similar to John's.
Why do you say it can be counterproductive?
Well, let me give you an example. Let's say that I'm a guy who mugs and robs people, and I'm a typical Heinz 57 Caucasian who's a little bit Indian, like most of us in Oklahoma here. A third of us have a little bit of Indian, somewhere between, I don't know, an eighth and a 128th. I happen to be a 16th. My wife's an eighth. And this is very typical of people in Oklahoma. But let's hear, I'm a Heinz 57 Caucasian. I'm robbing a black guy. Let's say I'm a real bigot, okay? I've got him at gunpoint. And I don't call him, I slap him one time and call him a nigger, okay? They will punish me more strenuously than if I beat him up pretty bad and didn't call him anything. Now, what kind of law is that?
Hmm.
Like I could beat him up really bad and not call him anything and not be punished as strongly in some states as only slapping him once and calling him a nigger. So that doesn't make any sense at all. Also, I think the way that they detail hate crimes, quite often, there's no standard way of doing it. By the way, the first time the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of them, it punished three black kids for beating hell out of a Caucasian kid after they'd seen Mississippi burning and going to go whoop up on Hawaii.
Hmm.
And I think they should have been gotten for assault and battery or aggravated assault, whatever, but I don't see that something should have been added to the sentence of these black kids because of their motivation.
Do you think these kinds of measures have any deterrent effect?
Not at all. I can remember them talking about Matthew Shepard, that poor little gay guy who got killed and hung up on the fence and so forth. They said, that shows we need hate crimes. That kind of thing will not deter people who do that sort of thing, and they're going to spend their lives in prison, or is one of them going to be executed? I don't remember, but they will not be getting out of prison, and what else can you do to them? Something like, oh, if we do this, we'll get a third more put on our sentence, does not deter hate-filled people who want to hurt somebody.
Stuart Rosenbaum?
Well, I agree with that. I do agree with that. I just, I think what needs to happen, one thing that needs to happen in any case is that justice moves more swiftly, if possible.
Yeah, right.
It seems to me that adding another charge on top of the standard criminal charge doesn't really add a lot of doesn't add any deterrence, in fact. But it seems to me to move the whole process more swiftly and more certainly would be useful.
Oh, yeah.
This kind of legislation, though, or this kind of action on the part of the state, isn't it? Can't it serve, though, as a way of, in a sense, standing up at the table and walking out, you know, making a statement? We don't condone this. We will not be. We want to deter it.
We make that sort of statement all the time. One of the main things that this country stands for, and especially has stood for over the past 10, 15, 20 years, is that you should not detest people because of their groups. This is so very common. People act like that there's just racism raging all around us. Now, I would like to speak as a person who was the only Caucasian member of NAACP and CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, in the early 60s in a southwestern state. I never put my neck on the chopping block, so to speak. I never had to. I don't know if I would have had the courage to do so, since I'm only of average courage. But I can tell you that relations among groups are so much better than they were back then, there is simply no comparison. We were trying to get people to quit using the N-word all the time and to say Negro instead. And finally we won, but we had a short-lived victory. Soon Negro was out and you had to use Black, which is, I don't care, whatever people want to be called, but shouldn't call them what they don't want to be called. And this was something that I was constantly arguing with people around me about this. They did not believe in integration. They wanted separate drinking fountains. They wanted separate schools. They wanted separate restaurants and restrooms and things like that. And I found myself alone arguing about this. Then, 25 years later, the same people I was arguing with didn't remember that that's how it was. What they remembered was, oh, I never had anything against the Black people. I've always been for them. I don't understand why anybody felt that way. Because we have a tendency to remember the past in ways that reflect better on us than we really were at the time. Two wonderful mm-hmm. examples of that would be Lillian Hellman, who claimed she was not really a Stalinist. She just was against McCarthy, which is ridiculous. She was a down-the-line Stalinist and a fellow traveler with the Communist Party. And Oswald Mosley over in the United Kingdom, who claimed he just was trying to keep the United Kingdom out of war. And that is totally ridiculous. He was Hitler's voice in the island. So people have a tendency to remember things in ways that reflect much better on them than they were really behaving yeah. at the time.
Well, the time has flown by here this afternoon. I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you and talking to Stuart.
Yeah, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it also.